Well, hello. Welcome to this week's podcast of the ICF Germany Charter with our special guest, Benita Mayhead, or Dr. Benita Mayhead, as I may say now, since she just recently completed a doctorate in coaching and mentoring at Oxford Brookes University in the UK. And it's great to have you here, Benita.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited.
And so are we. And we are going to talk today about actually the topic of your doctoral work, which is on duty of care. And before we get started, let me just briefly introduce Benita to our listeners. Benita is a very experienced coach. She started her career in HR management in international roles. And then I think for almost past 25 years, you've been coaching. And she has a long list of certifications and experiences and interests. And most recently, as I said, she completed her doctorate in coaching and mentoring at Oxford Brookes in the UK on the topic of duty of care. And when I first heard about this topic, I just thought like this interesting. It kind of rings a bell for me as a coach. I think it should for many coaches, but it's not a, I won't say an obvious, but it's a topic that I think needs a bit of explaining how you got there and what actually created so much interest and passion from your end to actually go for a doctorate. Because I think this is kind of the heavy piece, the big thing. And so I think before we look at the findings and the recommendations for us coaches out of your research, it would be great to know what triggered you to look at that topic.
Thank you, Felix. It's a really good question because, as you say, duty of care is not necessarily something that we are consciously thinking about and processing in the work that we do. And it can be considered to be quite a dry topic and not particularly interesting when we come to ethics. It can be a little bit of a, oh, okay, need to do this. But where the motivation came from is, as you said, I've been in the field for a few decades in learning and development, and it's our field of coaching is the second fastest growing industry field, just behind technology. And we don't have many barriers to entry. I mean, there's the good work that ICF does and the other coaching bodies with credentialing and accrediting people. And I think organizations are becoming a lot more aware of what they're bringing in terms of the robustness and experience and what coaches actually have on paper. But with few barriers to entry, my thinking was we are very much in privileged positions as coaches. The work we do is incredibly complex. It's important. And we have to take it seriously. So when we think about our own duty of care, what does that mean to me as a practitioner, either as an executive coach or coach supervisor, is of relevance. And when I looked at the literature on this and what do we know, what's been researched in our field, it's very sparse. We have handbooks which talk to us about best practice, which is incredibly helpful. We have ethical codes of conduct. So we have the ICF code of conduct. We have, for the other coaching bodies that are part of the global code of ethics, we have that. But when we really shine a light on duty of care specifically, there was very little out there. When we cast the net a bit wider and we look at other related professions, so in coaching, we've drawn a lot from related fields, related helping professions of psychotherapy and counselling, for example. And those areas are far more developed in their maturity and their understanding. And duty of care is pulled out and is held up on its own. So what I wanted to do was to make a contribution to our field, to make a contribution to our theoretical basis, but also to practice in what does duty of care mean to coaches, how do they make sense of it, and how importantly do they enact it. Mm-hmm. So that's where the motivation came from.
Mm-hmm. Now thanks so much for sharing that. My question is Again, coming your motivation kind of starting point, has there been instances where you say that, for instance, coaches were neglecting their duty of care, where you've seen basically the consequences out of that, and you say this is something that shouldn't happen?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. If we do allow ourselves to pause and to reflect, and this came through with the participants in the research. So there were 30 highly skilled and experienced executive coaches that took part in this research, and it was a given with them all. Of course, I have a duty of care. Of course, I do. But when they were invited to sit back and to really think and to then say, well, okay, what does it mean to you? And how do you form your understanding of it? Where does it come from? And how do you show it? It was quite difficult for people to answer it. So therefore, unless we do engage more in that reflective practice in terms of what does it mean to me, how do we know that we are how we are enacting it? So in terms of deliberate acts, not at all. I mean, in any coaches that I've worked with, no, there's no deliberate. However, we might not always necessarily be aware of the ripple effect, and when we think
Okay.
about it from the systemic nature and what might be happening through our actions.
Which is obviously a great lead over to the results of your research or the findings, especially ripple effects are especially interesting topic, as you just mentioned, because it just shows like it goes beyond just a coachee relationship. And so I would be curious to know more about that.
Yeah, okay. Well, with the findings, with first of all, in how do we as coaches form our understanding of duty of care? Where it comes from is through our own sense making, from our own life experiences. It comes from role models, it comes from what we've seen around us, it comes from our own values, and it comes from our own beliefs. It comes from our own development and our own growth as coaches, which happens a lot in reflective dialogue and also in supervision, importantly, and through peers. And in the research, two-thirds of the participants were affiliated to a coaching body, but one-third were not. But consistently across the research, which was important, is an important point, coaches didn't reach for codes of conduct, and they didn't reach for handbooks on how to enact their duty of care when they were in an ethical dilemma. Interestingly, what they would do is they would reach for their supervisor, or they'd reach for a peer, they reached for somebody to talk to. So this is an important point in how we, and it's not saying that these coaches disregarded those codes of ethics, not at all, very much practice, but it wasn't their go-to point. So this brought to the fore in the findings, and one of the implications for practice is how important it is that coaches do engage in supervision, not just when they are having a difficult time, but this being part and parcel of their practice. So this being part and parcel of how they are. So it really positions that piece of coach development in that exploration of who am I and how am I showing up, and to whom do I have a duty of care to, is really position this very centrally in terms of the coach's practice and in their own development, and the role the supervisor can play within that as well.
Now you just mentioned supervision. Obviously, you know that supervision is not with all the bodies, for instance, one a requirement for certification. So, of the 30 executive coaches you've been working with, how many of those actually have supervisors?
Across the board, the majority had supervision. Now, interestingly, when we look at what the coaching bodies suggest with supervision, an interesting point that came through is the more experienced, for those coaching bodies that do advocate that coaches have supervision, the guidelines are the more experienced you are as a coach, the less supervision you need. Now, actually, what the research showed was the opposite. So, from the findings, what came through was these were highly experienced coaches, as I mentioned. These were executive coaches that worked at very senior levels. The more experienced they were and the greater maturity they had in their coaching practice, the more supervision they wanted, because the level of complexity in the caseloads that they had was greater, became more complicated. So they were turning to supervision more. Now, and this is something that comes through for when we think about our own field, because again, when we look at related helping professions, when we look at, you know, psychotherapy or counselling, for example, the requirements for supervision are quite different to how we look at supervision and coaching. The requirement is it's not about caseload. It's not about just if you are in a difficult time as well, but it's about having a consistent amount of supervision and being able to demonstrate that. So it was something that almost turned some thinking perhaps around on this. So where we thought the more experienced you are, the less you need. What the research showed was the opposite. So this is an invitation for coaching audience in their thinking. And okay, well, how do we view this? But understanding that it's and it's different geographically. So when we use the supervision a lot in the UK, for example, but in the US, it's a different language that's used.
I just wonder how much of this is also a topic for coach training. What I mean with that, obviously, is that I think most people going into coaching have no previous knowledge or little. I mean, no formal training. So I think they're kind of starting with a blank sheet, and they obviously we learn as coaches what we are being taught. And we know, again, I mean, you mentioned that at the beginning, since there's no formal requirement to be a coach and things like that, I think we have lots of different coach training providers out there. And I just wonder how much this then is embedded in their teaching, their training, so that one starts there early on to get at least the idea. Maybe I'm too much a novice to say, okay, I'm just going there, but at least I know that this is a topic supervision that I should be looking at. And just from a point you just mentioned, kind of understand what are the elements, why do I go for supervision, and what's the benefit compared to other tools, books, whatever I can also access. How do you think is their importance?
Yeah, there's a couple of points within there. There's a supervision piece, as we've just touched on. And then, as you say there, with the coach education and the training. And there are some incredibly good training providers that really take this very seriously. And they include ethics robustly in their programs, and ensuring that coaches that are going through any training with them, that they cover this. Yet, through the research, A, it's very difficult to ascertain the level of ethics training, the quality and the amount that training providers offer. It's very difficult to ascertain that. That would be a whole research study on its own. But what I can share is from the research, which was primary research, the participants, the majority didn't cite their coach education training as being formative in terms of their own understanding and sense making of duty of care. It came from back to the point of their own life experience, their values and role models and what they've seen around them. And then with some of them, again, you know, this happened a few times in the interviews where, when thinking about the developmental side of it and what had they learned through training or through certification, specifically on the ethics part of it, it was left many with them scratching their heads. And again, I'm having to really think about that now, which demonstrates to me that actually it wasn't a major part of the work. Typically with coach training providers, a lot of time is spent on competencies, on, you know, the act of coaching and what's happening. But this subtlety of this thread of duty of care, you know, my argument is that this isn't switched on and off. This is there the whole way through. It's omnipresent. It transcends all actions that we do as coaches, all interactions we have. It's there continually.
Which, if I take what you just said with the systemic nature that you mentioned earlier on, I mean, this sounds rather complex or complicated. So how do I, and obviously my role as a coach is to coach, to help the other person. How do I kind of think about this and include it in a way that, for instance, I'm obviously busy with my coachee, and obviously I know that they're part of a system and so on, so, but at least my current counterpart is the coachee. I'm sitting with this person in my coaching session, and so I just wonder if this, as much as I appreciate the duty of care, and don't misunderstand me, please, but this is an additional element that could take away energy and focus for me from my coachee. And I just wonder what your recommendation would be to kind of respect it and reflect it in what I'm doing, but not be overly disturbed by it so that I lose contact and relationship with my coachee.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the questions that coaches can ask themselves on a practical level is, to whom do I have a duty of care to? Mm-hmm. So this being the first part of it. And do I just have a duty of care to the person I'm coaching, to the client, as I call them? Or do I also have a duty of care if coaches are working in an executive coach capacity? Do I also have a duty of care to the organization? So to who is paying the bill? What the research suggests is, yes, there is a duty of care to multiple parties in the relationship. But how far on does it go from there? Do I have a duty of care to an indirect duty of care to people who are not in the room, neither the client nor the customer? One example with one of the participants in the research, they said, I will not conduct any coaching calls when I'm driving my car. If somebody says to me, I can only speak to you when I'm driving, this coach was absolutely clear, saying, absolutely, I will not coach you when you are driving. What happens if you have an insightful moment and your concentration goes? What happens then if you are involved in an accident? What's my duty of care to your family? So in terms of the coach's own actions, in terms of not only how are they showing up, but also thinking about the environment part of it. And this comes down also then to, on the practical part of it, in how we can manage our own conduct as coaches. How do we contract? This is a very pivotal point, really, within this. You know, how do we contract? What goes into our contracting in an explicit nature in what I, you know, how I will work and how I won't work? The coach, has come through from the research, is the one that they are the custodian of setting those limits and or managing those boundaries, which is difficult. It's difficult. And I think, to your point, if we can as coaches lay out very clear boundaries and we have very clear contracting in the beginning, then this can then help ensure that we don't get distracted and that we can keep focus on what's going on in the session. But then recontracting as well. And the other part within there is how we enact and how we show our duty of care. Part of that is ending the coaching relationship. So our duty of care is about how we step away from it when the work here is done, and so that coaching doesn't drift. And this then comes back to the point of the customer. So what value is the customer getting? And you know, our duty of care is to ensure that we are adding value. And we end the coaching relationship when the work is done.
I understand. Yeah, it's quite interesting. Yeah. I think especially with all the endings. I think my impression is that as I think as human beings, we sometimes are not like that good at endings. It's just period and off we go. And I think, as you rightly say, the duty of care continues there as much as other things, and just being clear on what are implications of what we're doing. If in longer term. Now, another, you mentioned just the drive in the car example, which I think is a really important one. I assume that your research obviously has happened during COVID predominantly.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, it's my impression is that before COVID, and especially before online coaching, which I think now has become obviously as a standard, is that being together in one room, which obviously still happens, creates a different setting. Whereas now, obviously, I mean, we're conducting this, we're recording this podcast over Zoom. So basically, I see the window, but I don't see the environment around you. And so the question, and as easy as it is to say, we can basically, it's very spontaneous, do a coaching session. The question is how this mobility or so affects also duty of care.
Yeah.
I don't know how you see that. Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Something that we in our company at North 52, something that we have adopted that has been impacted through the research, through this study, and also through what we've experienced with moving to online, is the environment part of it. There are some things that we say to our clients when we are working with them virtually. Mm. One is, if you are able to change the location within where you have your coaching session, in your house, so that you are not jumping straight from one call that you've been having on Teams to your Zoom call with your coach. And the reason for that is, if you were working with someone in an office, you wouldn't be going and sitting next to them at their desk to do mm-hmm. coaching. You'd go into a meeting room, you'd be in a potential space. The other thing as well, again, in thinking about how we can influence the value that our clients are getting from the coaching, is simple things such as having a pause before you go onto your coaching call with your coach, and also at the end. So even with looking at booking 75-minute calls deliberately, so that an hour and a half is blocked out of someone's diary and they have time either side. So I think that environment part is really important. And again, coming back to the coach and how they enact it, it's up to them to set those standards. Yeah, you know, yeah. It's up to the coach to take responsibility and to be talking to the client before they're going into any coaching engagement, in terms of, this is my duty of care to you to ensure that you get the best value from this. Mm-hmm.
Which I think is an important aspect, really, as you mentioned it, because with the contracting part, I often think that obviously there's a huge imbalance in knowledge and experience between the client and us coaches, because for most clients, it's the first time they're being coached. And I think, therefore, I completely agree with you that it's important to set the frame and everything clearly, and understand where this person is coming and what they just need to know, so that that the coaching can be successful. But I think also that they're protected in their environment, and that they know duty of care, that we care for them. And
with that point, you know, the word care, this is a huge word, and it's, some more work needs to be done on this. But care came through in the research as being very, very, very central. So this being around, and not to be confused with taking care of, mm-hmm. but this being around this sense of, I care about what I do. I take this seriously, as I said at the beginning of the call. So for the coach, in thinking, you know, I do care about what I do, I care about my actions, I care about the work. And but there's a boundary piece here with coaches and with duty of caring. When does it tip in to overcaring? Mm-hmm. So when does it tip in to the coach is so invested in what it is that they're doing? The coach is worrying about a client after a session. And there were some very helpful examples that some of the participants shared in the research where this has happened, mm-hmm. you know, where a coach hasn't been able to get hold of somebody and they've been worried about them. And this sense of worry and this sense of the client coming with them metaphorically, they are in their head for quite a while afterwards. So the duty of care part in here then also, it relates to the coach themselves in what's their duty of care to themselves. So not only are we looking out, we're looking to the client, we're looking to the customer, we're looking to the ripple effect of the people who are not in the room, but we also need to look to ourselves. We it has to start with us. That duty of care and how we take care of ourselves is of utmost importance.
There's just a picture coming up. It's that just came to my mind, which is a pilot, a commercial airline pilot, and who clearly has to assure that his airplane is functioning, that he is functioning, that his team is functioning, the whole group, and then yes, there are the passengers that want to go from A to B, but it's does this kind of make sense that I start with my own system and just make sure that I am mentally and physically able to perform what I want to do, but I don't know that I put systems around me checks like at the beginning of a coaching session, am I myself in the state? You mentioned changing rooms and things like that. I mean, the same thing happens. Am I sitting at the same place that I'm doing my accounting work And then, whoops, there's the coaching session, and just no moving, no break. So that's an important part of duty of care is actually, as I mentioned, with us.
It is. And to build on your metaphor of the airline pilot, as we are told when we are having the safety briefing, when we are flying anywhere, we are told to put your own oxygen mask on before you help others. Exactly that. We need to care for ourselves. We need to fuel ourselves in the different ways that shows up. We are the integral instrument in this. The coach needs to be aware of that. So duty of care applied to them as well.
And just carry on that thought now. And how would you recommend that we as coaches address duty of care with our clients? Because I mean, you just mentioned the safety briefing, and obviously that's so how are there any tips that you say, okay, these are kind of things you should be doing just to be, yeah, just to, again, it's like a checklist. Don't forget about these things, mentioning that, for instance, early on or at the beginning of every session again, or in recontracting. It's just important to bring this up again because it could be easily be forgotten by either side.
There are some key points. On the legal side of it, we've been talking more about, I guess, some of the, you know, the ethical pieces in here, but we have the legality of duty of care, which is essential to this. That means that, you know, ensuring written contracts are in place, ensuring terms of engagement are in place, ensuring that the client, the organization, the standards of expectation as to what they are wanting to get from this coaching, this has been clearly articulated and this is understood, so that things coaches don't just drift into starting a coaching assignment with somebody, but getting those basics in place is really important. And that's for the protection of all parties in a coaching relationship. It's for the coach, but also for the client and for the organization. It's about the coach remembering that they are the ones that set the standards, and they're the ones that manage the boundaries, that they manage the limits. It's about contracting and recontracting, as we've already talked about, and not being afraid to end the coaching relationship. It's for the coach themselves in how they view their own ethical development and their own ethical maturity as a coach, and how they are continually investing in themselves to explore that. And for those that are providing the coach training, there's a huge responsibility here for them in ensuring, you know, what is it that I'm including in this as well. So those are some points that keeping those at the forefront of our own minds can be helpful.
Excellent. Excellent tips. Thanks so much for sharing them with us and the listeners, because I think it's a exciting topic. It's an important topic. And obviously the more concrete, the more behavior it becomes to say, okay, these are things we should be doing. I think the easier it is for us to all to get there to where we should be, where we probably are not yet, but to bring this topic to the forefront. Now, the last question I have is around supervision, because you mentioned that obviously coaches in your research also often turn to fellow coaches or supervisors. And again, I mean, supervision, like coaching, at least in the coaching sphere, is not regulated. So, and how do you see it there? So how well equipped are supervisors or aware or see their roles also in the duty of care sphere? Because I think, again, in supervision, a supervision session, you can easily look at other parts of your coaching practice, then, so that it may become more a coaching for coaches than a supervision for coaches. And so, and how do you see that from your, maybe from your research also, how good supervisors are at doing that?
Exactly as you say, you know, supervisors that are not regulated, it's good to see so many more options available now for supervisors to become qualified. So myself and my colleagues, we are all qualified coach supervisors, and take it as seriously as we do with coaching. So, and I think that's something for people who are looking for a supervisor in exploring what the credentials are, what the background is, and for those that are looking to become supervisors and to develop their own coaching practice and to become coach supervisors, again, is to look at who you are going to become qualified, because it's a very different area than coaching. Of course, there are similarities and there's crossover, but it's much more about, you know, supervisor and coach, you're working sort of like in that thinking partnership. It's peers coming together, as that's how we see it, and therefore different to coaching, when often it can be around, you know, enabling the thinking of the person you're working with. It's not about giving the answers, but with supervision, it transcends into different areas again. So for the supervisor, and for them really reflecting and thinking on what's my duty of care here to the client, but also to the customer, because when we look at related bodies of research as well, there have been cases where there's been the question of proximity. So there's been a responsibility if somebody has given advice and there has been an impact to a third party, there's been issues there. So it's something to be thought about.
Which again, I think kind of mirrors or brings up the theme again of reflecting what we're doing and having enough time by ourselves and with the supervisor and other people to reflect on our practice and to, and as you mentioned also from research, to as we become more experienced, not let it go, but actually being able to kind of have more complex thinking and more complex reflection about more complex topics, which at the end probably also advance us as coaches in our practice, so that we don't kind of stand still. Well, Benita, that's very, very much very exciting. Thanks very much for sharing all those experiences with us and our listeners. Is there anything that we haven't touched on which you think is important? Again, our listeners are predominantly ICF coaches, and obviously we have our own standards, as you mentioned. We have our requirements. But is there anything which you say that, as it, we didn't touch on yet, which would be important for them to know?
I think that it's an important for, you know, to acknowledge that, you know, coaches work with goodwill. They work with positive intent. And I think when definitely from the participants in this research, duty of care was a given, and yet the majority had not consciously thought about it. So I think that, you know, with ICF is thinking about how can ICF get this topic more explicitly out there. When we look at the ethical codes that are there, it's not explicitly stated. There's implied meaning. So I think that's it. And I think just celebrating the good work that coaches do and this piece of research is the aim is for it to be to enhance and to help progress our field, to help develop our theoretical underpinnings of understanding on what it is. So to help strengthen that.
Well, I mean, at least with this podcast in the ICF community, and we obviously reach quite a bit of ICF coaches. And since it's in English, coaches around the world can listen in, and probably I hope this is a little stone in the to kind of build more awareness and better quality around duty of care with coaches around the world, and especially ICF coaches. Benita, thanks very much for being with us. It was very enjoyable. I hope you enjoyed it as well.
Very much did. Thank you for having me, Felix.
Thank you for being here. And thank you for listeners to listen in. And we look forward to having you next week with an exciting topic around coaching. Thank you very much.